Hi, good evening, everyone. I'm Janet B. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. I'm here in the frozen state of New Jersey. Went to bed yesterday and it was Florida and woke up and it was Alaska. But here we are, and I'm really excited to come and talk about the latter part of step four. We spent some time talking about defect inventories and resentments. So we are going to pick up with fears on page 67. And is there, I forgot to ask, Bonnie, do you have your book and could you read for me?
Yes, I would love to.
Starting with notice at the word.
Perfect. And how far do I go, Janet?
That paragraph.
Okay, perfect. No, notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we didn't deserve. But did we not ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Thank you.
So that says a lot of really interesting stuff here. So some stuff we know, right? Like, okay, yeah, we all feel it. It touches about every aspect of our lives. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it, yada, yada, whatever. And then it says it was evil. What? You're telling me that an emotion is evil? I mean, when I'm happy, no one says that that's whatever the opposite of evil is. And when I'm sad, no one calls it evil, but they're saying fear is evil. So that says to me, fear is something more than an emotion. So let's just kind of put that aside for a second. And they call it corroding, which means it makes me think of rusty pipes. You get a little rust and it just wrecks the pipes. And then it says something really interesting, that fear set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. So it reminds me of a line earlier in the book that says, our troubles are basically of our own making. And here they're telling me that fear sets things in motion. It's like a negative spiritual catalyst that brings us trouble. Well, how can that be? That doesn't really make sense. And I think we tend to think of fear maybe improperly. And we use other words to describe it, like anxiety, worry, nervousness. And what all of this is being concerned that a future event isn't going to go the way that I want it to. And isn't that playing God? So they're telling me it's evil and it sets things in motion. And I was just thinking about this today. It's the craziest example. I was early 20s and I had a boyfriend, and I was going to a meeting in a different state and he was coming up later and he gave this other girl a ride. And they'd been friends for a while. And all of a sudden I got this fear, like, oh, he's going to end up dating her. And you know the story, he did. And so I always thought of that, like my fear, I wonder if my fear had anything to do with it. And I know we can all, you know, think of things like that. Like when I was a kid, one time I grew up in sunny Florida and played ball in our backyard all the time. And one time my father said to me, make sure you don't break a window. Never said that to me before. Guess what happened that night? You know, I broke a window. So those are like little silly examples, but I'm sure we all have some. And sometimes we have bigger ones, right? You know, fear our kids will whatever. And so what do? We try to rein them in more tightly so they don't do whatever and they end up rebelling. Well, that's on a normal earth plane. But I think they're talking about a spiritual plane. So if we think of step two, right, where it says came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, we have to believe it. Our belief in a good, loving God who can help us, that actually gets the process going. It's like that presses the cosmic start button. So if I have fear that something bad's going to happen, I'm pressing another cosmic button, but it's not the one that's run by God. It's the one run by the other team. Fear is an evil and corroding thread, sets in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. And then it says, but did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? So my fear actually has like spiritual power to make yucky things happen. So I don't want anyone to leave here being afraid of their fear, because fortunately our God is good and gave us a way to work through these fears. But I just want to, you know, again, reiterate, if ever someone calls me and says, I'm anxious, I'm worried, I'm nervous, what I generally say is like, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a life coach, but I know how to deal with fear. So if we call it fear, now we know what to do. Now we can do an inventory on it. Let's finish up this paragraph to see what else they say about this like evil and corroding thread. They say, we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. And I was just thinking, okay, like when you think of like, don't steal, what class is it in? What list? And I automatically think of the 10 commandments, right? Thou shalt not steal. And they're telling me fear is kind of in the same category. Like it's in the big 10 of things we shouldn't do. And I thought, why? Like, you know, being sad isn't up there. Why is fear? And then I think it's the first commandment. It's either the first or the second. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. And of course, in the big book, it says either God is everything or else he's nothing. If I have fear, then I'm not looking to press the cosmic good button. I've got my faith in a higher power, a, you know, little h, little p, that I'm making bigger than God. So they say fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble than stealing, which could get us, you know, 10 years in jail. So that's how bad fear is. So knowing that, like, I want to be rid of them. I want to be rid of anxiety, fear, nervousness, worry. So I want to just briefly say a couple of fears that I think we all, or a lot of us have, and that we have to work through. Fear of what other people will think about us. And how do we set the ball rolling? If I'm afraid of what you're going to think about me, I'm going to act in a way that I think will get you to like me, regardless of whether, you know, I'm being true to myself. And then what's going to happen? I'm going to get mad at you because you've made me act against my own values. And then if you don't respond, right, I do all these nice things for you, and then you don't reciprocate, I'm going to get really mad. But it's all based on my fear. It's not based on love. It's not based on, I'll do the right thing for you, and how you respond is none of my business. It's like today, my son is a freshman in college, and he's going back in a couple days, and he said he may not be home for spring break, so we won't see him till summer. He may like hang out with his friends. So I said, oh, Dad and I will come down and visit you for a weekend. And he's like, yeah, no, I won't have time. I'll wave at you. Maybe I'll go out to dinner with you. And my heart was like hurt. And I started, you know, getting mad. And it's like, oh. And then I realized, you know what? My job is to love him and do the right thing. And whether he wants me to come down and spend a weekend with him in gratitude for all my sacrifices is none of my business. I'm just going to keep loving him. And then fortunately, my daughter, who is now a junior, said, Mom, you have to understand, you know, you freshmen, it's their first year getting all this independence. So it'll pass. It's normal. So see, but when I like kind of, God gave me help in the form of my wise third year college daughter. Another fear that we always have, especially as parents, is that our children will have pain. If they don't do whatever, they won't graduate college in 4 years. They won't go to college. They'll go to college and not become a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. They won't marry the right person. They won't go to church. And then their lives will be horrible. But again, that's me playing God. If they only do everything I want, their life will be perfect and they won't have pain. And who says that, you know, everyone's supposed to have a pain-free life? You know, I certainly didn't. But it's so this wanting to shield our children from pain, and it becomes a big fear, right? Fear that they'll do whatever. And honestly, when I like really look at it, my child's decisions, especially once they're 18, are none of my business. Now I can decide not to support them, right? If my daughter came to me, this is hypothetical, she didn't do this, and said, Mom, I've decided I want to be a heroin addict. Now I can say, that's fine, honey. But if you want to do that, I'm not going to be paying, you know, for your apartment anymore. I can set boundaries, but no fear. So I just wanted to mention, so I was thinking, those are, I think, two of the biggest fears that we have. Okay, so now that we decided we don't want fear, what do we do about it? So Bonnie, can you continue reading, please, with review? We reviewed. Can you unmute, please?
There you go. Thanks. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse.
Thanks. So it tells us, okay, you have a fear, you write it down, and why do we have it? Now, I've seen inventory sheets where it says, were you in self-reliance? Check yes or no. Well, obviously it's always yes. But I heard a practice once that was really helpful to me. So I'm just going to pass it on in case it's helpful to you. We asked ourselves why we had them. We drill down. So here's an example of one of mine, and this is actually a true one. My daughter was 16, so this was 4 years ago, and I don't remember what she did, but it was something I felt I needed to talk to her about. And I saw that I had a fear of, I don't want to use the word confronting, but let's use that word, confronting my daughter with whatever she did. And I saw, I have a fear of that. Why? And so I drilled down. If I confront her, punish her, whatever, then once she's 18, she'll leave home and never want to talk to me again. Okay, then what? I keep drilling. If she never wants to talk to me again, then when I'm an old lady and my husband and son are dead, neither of them are sick, by the way, I'll be all alone on Thanksgiving. If I'm all alone on Thanksgiving, I will be sad. And so usually the drill down, we can drill down until we get to, I will be sad or I will be uncomfortable. So when I did that, I saw that I wasn't saying to her what I needed to then in the present as an insurance policy for 20 years down the line so that I'd have a place to go on holidays. And that was selfish. So once I realize this, I can ask God to remove the fear and to see what action he would have me take and then take it. So it tells us what we do. It says, perhaps there's a better way, right, than having great self-confidence. We're now on a different basis. What basis are we on? Remember, Step four comes after steps two and three, trusting step two and relying upon God. We trust him, we rely on him, we do what he wants. And then it has a formula coming up. It says, we're in the world to play the role he assigns. That's my purpose. That's why I'm created. Now here's the formula. This is the formula to always have serenity. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? So it's X units of doing his will, right? X units of obedience plus Y units of trusting him equals XY units of serenity, even when there's calamity. So if I'm agitated, I need to ask myself, where am I not doing what I think God wants me to? And or where am I not trusting God? And this is how we, whenever we are feeling agitated, we can diagnose ourselves. Where am I not acting in accordance with God's will? Or where am I not trusting him? And then it says, okay, you know, people may kind of tease you for depending on God and say, oh, that spiritual stuff, that just makes you weak. And they're saying, yeah, no, through the ages, faith actually meant courage. All men of faith have courage. And that means even when things are scary, we trust God and we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. That's really a powerful line. We let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We are supposed to be conduits for God's power and love. And so we ask him to remove our fear, right? God, please remove it. Just like we ask him to remove our resentments, we ask him to remove it. What a good God, right? That's the price. It's like sometimes you go to a therapist, the price is, you know, you lay down $200 for an hour. To get God's help, you ask. Now, yeah, he can read our minds. Of course, he's God, but that's how he designed it. He wants us to ask. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. Now, in the paragraph above, it says, what we would do. Some people get hung up on, well, is it what I should do or what I should be? We ask God to remove our fears. What should we do? What should we be? We're not going to get hung up on the word here. Sometimes it's an action to take. Sometimes what he would have me be, just trusting in him. And it says that once we commence to outgrow fear, it may not all go away, but it should begin to go away. And then they go and they start talking about the sex inventory. And what I find really interesting is they say in this book is we treat sex as we would any other problem. So they tell us that we go back, we analyze our sex conduct over the past to see where we were selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate. And they say, you know, be careful. Yes, you can talk to other people about it and get their opinions, but they say voices run to extreme. And they say, we want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. And in my book, I crossed out the word sex conduct and I wrote, fill in the blank. We are not the arbiter of anyone's politics. And unless we're their sponsor, and even then only to a point, we're not arbiter of other people's food plans. We're not arbiters of, you know, people's view on, you know, whether, I don't know, critical race theory should be taught or things like that. We are people, like, we are not life coaches. Our job here isn't to convince people to take another point of view. Right? We stay out of controversy. So I just find that's really helpful as a general view in life, what they tell us to do. And for me, I'm less likely to be agitated. You know, I don't have to win every argument. I don't have to prove that I'm right. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What matters is, am I being a conduit for God's love? Not his brilliant intellect. It doesn't say that anywhere in this book. It's not that if I show how smart I am, people are going to think how smart God is. It never works that way. But it works with love. So that's what we're supposed to do. But we continue on with our inventory and we look at our past relationships and we look at who did we hurt? How are we selfish? Should we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? What should we have done instead? Very often what we should have done was not gotten involved with that person or left the relationship as soon as certain red flags came up. That's what came up for me often in my inventory. And then it says we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. How am I going to be in the future? You know, for someone who's not married, it may be, when is it okay for them to, you know, have sex? Can they have sex with someone they meet at a bar? Do they have to be engaged? Do they have to wait until they're married? And again, it says, we stay out of it. My ideal may be totally different than my sponsor's or my sponsee's ideal. It's okay. It's between the person and God. And just for people in a relationship, I haven't listened to it in a while, but I know it was by a married woman about a sex ideal within her marriage, how to act within a marriage. And it was probably the best podcast I've ever listened to. So it's on A Vision for You. And it was on January 27th, 2019. There's three people speaking. The first one is Gina R. She talks about the sex ideal within a marriage. And it was just, I promise you, you're going to take pages of notes. Everyone does. And as a bonus, Melissa is the second person speaking on the podcast about step 10. So, you know, welcome to continue and listen to her as well. So if you want to post the link to it in the chat, that would be awesome. Okay, so it tells us whatever our ideal is, we have to be willing to grow toward it. So we may not like it. I didn't like the sex ideal that I felt I was called to, but I was willing because I made a commitment to do God's will. And it says, we must be willing to make amends where we've caused harm unless it would cause any more harm. And then this is a really instructive line. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. We make amends unless doing so would harm others. We seek God's will. And if we're not sure what to do in a given situation, listen to this. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. I mean, we've probably read those words so many times that the like awesomeness of it escapes us. The right answer will come from God. That means we can go to God, ask a question and expect an answer. If we're not, you know, filled with dishonesty, amends that we know we should have made and we haven't, you know, resentment, fear. In other words, if the channel isn't clogged up, we can expect an answer. Now, for myself, I don't always get answers. When I do, it's often a line out of the Bible, a line out of the big book, or sometimes a line from a song. I've never heard a voice, although some people have. So God speaks to people, I think, in different ways, but they're telling us that if we want an answer, if we want it badly enough to unclog the channel and to ask and to practice getting quiet and listening, the right answers will come. And again, they say God alone can judge our sex situation, that it's up to God. It says counsel with other persons is often desirable. I'm on the top of page 70. We let God be the final judge. We realize some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. And I would say in all areas, right? Not just in the area of sex, in all areas. And then they say, okay, what if we fall short and we stumble? If we fall short of our ideal, are we going to get drunk? Like, that's how seriously they take it. They say, they start questioning, okay, if I fall down on my sex ideal or start treating people badly, using other people, am I going to drink? Am I going to binge? And they say, maybe. They really say that. They say, it depends. And here's what makes the difference. If we're sorry for what we have done, and so two things, I'm sorry, meaning I wish I hadn't done it, and I have an honest desire to let God take me to better things, then I believe I'll be forgiven and will have learned my lesson. So I have to feel sorry, but not just like, you know, oh, I'm sorry I got caught. Yeah, I'm sorry because this wasn't good. I have to have a desire, not so much to change, but to be changed. There's a difference between trying to be better and letting God take me to better things. Trying to be better means I think I've got the power to do it. I don't have the power to change very much. So, but if I ask God, like, God, please forgive me for this harm I've done and change me, rewire my heart, take me to a higher level, make me a better person so that I'm not the type of person who does this anymore. See, because we can't just change and stop doing bad things very much. We are people who need to be changed so that we're different people. And that's what they're talking about, God taking us to better things. If we're not sorry and we continue harming other people, we are quite sure to drink. And I think this is really instructive because sometimes if someone goes off their food plan, a person might say to them, oh, it's definitely a first step problem. And I would submit that that's not necessarily true. I could know I'm powerless over food and my life is unmanageable, know it 100%, and still go around hurting other people. Well, my solution isn't to make myself know it more that I'm powerless. My solution is to stop hurting people. So sometimes we don't have to look at what do we think, we have to look at what are we doing, right? This program says faith without works is dead. You know, if I'm hurting others and I don't care, I may believe in God, but it's not doing me any good. And then they sum up about sex. It tells us what we pray for. Again, pray. You know, they take it for granted that we are people of prayer who like to commune with God. We pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, because we believe God will answer us, for sanity, right? For God to restore us to our right minds, and for strength to do the right thing. And they say, if sex is very troublesome, and again, I crossed out the word sex and I put fill in the blank. So if something in our life is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of other people's needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. When to yield, we're either in a tempting sexual situation or any situation that's difficult ends up in heartache, working with others. And then they just kind of summarize about step four. If we've been thorough, we've written down a lot, analyzed resentments, and we've begun to change. We've begun to understand that they're futile and they're fatal. But more than that, something, you know, we talk about how a spiritual experience is God rewiring our heart to make us less selfish and self-centered and more kind and loving like He is. And here's the fourth step promise. we have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. Okay, that's a four-step promise as we do this. And it says, for we look on them as sick people, but as we've discussed, we want to be really careful how often we use the word sick, you know, that often it's better to say, for we look on them as spiritually developing, just like me, or human beings with good points and bad points, just like me. And it says, in this book, you read again and again, faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves, right? We talked about that, about fear. It's like pressing a cosmic bad things happening. Faith, it's like pressing a cosmic good things happening. Faith allows things in the spiritual world to start working on our behalf. Spiritual principles, or I shouldn't say spiritual things, I should say God, to start working on our behalf. And then they end the chapter kind of with a prayer for us. We hope, this is their hope for us, that you're now convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. Again, a beautiful image, right? That I have blocks, right? I took a brick wall of my resentments, my fears, my nastiness, my harms to others, my vengefulness, my pride, my, you know, thinking I'm the center of the universe, built a big block wall, me on one side, God on the other. And it says, we hope you're now convinced that you have the tools to remove what's blocked you off. Oh, wait, it doesn't say that. It says, we hope you're convinced that God can remove it. So I built this wall, but God loves me so much, he's going to remove it because it's too heavy for me. God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you've already made a decision, and what's our decision? Step three, to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. And that's God as we understand him. And an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you've made a good beginning. This is only the beginning. All this good stuff that we have already is just the beginning. But it tells us, you know, it may be a little rough along the way that we swallow and digest some big chunks of truth about ourselves. You know, I used to think that I was like a great person, just people didn't treat me the way that Queen Janet deserved to be treated. And in this process, I saw that I wasn't as nice as I thought I was, and that there was no Queen Janet. There's only to be a King God. And if I center my life around him, then we all can see for sure that really and truly the age of miracles is still with us. And with that, I pass.